This is Law and Disorder.
For the first time in many, many years, socialism is no longer a dirty word. In fact, it's a conversation starter. We speak with Green Party candidate for governor Howie Hawkins on what it's like to run as a third party candidate, how it's hard to get on the ballot, and what kind of reception he's getting. We'll also speak with ex-prisoner and current editor of Prison Legal News, Paul Wright, on the three-week unprecedented national prison strike.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Former United States President Jimmy Carter has pointedly observed that the United States is not a democracy, it's an oligarchy. That is, it's a country ruled by a handful of rich people, the 1% at the expense of the vast majority, the 99%, that famous description we got from the Occupy movement. The political and ideological mechanism for keeping this state of affairs is the two-party system in the USA, which is in reality, as independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader has written, it's really a one party of big business with two wings, the Republicans and the Democrats. Although the two-party system was not mentioned in our Constitution, state laws make it extraordinarily difficult for a third independent party to get on the ballot. Their ideas receive little media exposure, reinforcing their exclusion. This lack in the political process, even as we are witnessing a radicalization, especially among young people, has led to a discussion on the left amongst socialists, democratic socialists, and progressives in general about how to move forward. The main question is being debated is, do we support socialists who run on the Democratic Party ticket? Or do we stay independent of the Democratic Party? Or do we work both inside and outside of the Democratic Party? We speak today with Howie Hawkins. He is a retired Teamster from Syracuse, New York, and the Green Party candidate for New York's governor. He previously ran as a Green Party gubernatorial candidate in both 2010 and 2014. During these campaigns, he received 5% of the vote. He's the author of the recent article, The Case for an Independent Left Party, From the Bottom Up. It was published in Black Agenda Report. Howie Hawkins, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks. Good to be here.
Howie, you're on the ballot as the Green Party candidate for governor of the state of New York. How did you get on the ballot?
Well, the Green Party had a convention and nominated me. And the reason we could do that without petitioning is that we got over 50,000 votes in 2010 and again in 2014, which gives us a ballot line. So the way the election law works is if you have a ballot line, if 25% or more of the delegates to your state committee or convention want you on the ballot, you're on. And if there's more than one candidate, there's a primary. In my case, it was unanimous and nobody petitioned to primary me. So I was the first candidate on the ballot, certified on the ballot in New York for governor this year.
What are the obstacles, both legal and political, for an independent party like the Green Party for getting on the ballot, not just in New York, but across the other 49 states?
Well, in every state it's different. Every state has its own laws, and some are very hard to get on the ballot, like Oklahoma, Georgia, until recently North Carolina, but the Greens won a lawsuit and got the petitioning requirements reduced. That's really the tough barrier, the very high petitioning requirements. Some states are easy. In Vermont and Florida and Mississippi, you just have to have a minimal level of organization. And most are in the middle. New York is among those. In our case, it's 50,000 votes for governor. In most states where they have a voting threshold, it's any statewide office, including the presidential voting. But in New York, it's just the vote for governor every 4 years. And some states you can have a certain number of people enrolled in the party and you get on, but usually it's a vote total in the different states. So for us, it was building up enough of a voter base to get over 50,000 votes, which I think we have pretty securely. We pretty much had a floor of 100,000 votes for the last 4 years for our candidates for statewide office. So that's why we're on the ballot.
Well, that's quite an achievement. Ralph Nader complained that when he tried to get on the ballot as an independent, the Democratic Party would challenge the signatures on his petitions, and he'd have to spend a lot of money that they would otherwise use for the campaign just to defend in these lawsuits.
Oh, yeah. In 2004, the attack on Nader was unprecedented. It was even worse than that against Henry Wallace in 1948. Richard Winger, who has a newsletter called Ballot Access News and is really the expert on this, says Nader was attacked, and many of these lawsuits were frivolous. They even sent people in to, create petitions with false signatures to then allege fraud against the petition. It was really bad. So he survived in most states, but he had to spend a lot of effort defending himself just to be on the ballot.
We talked about the legal obstacles to getting on the ballot. What about the political ones in terms of just getting coverage for your positions?
Well, when I go into, small cities and towns upstate, I get coverage. They're interested. They appreciate the fact that I showed up. In this Democratic primary, there's a lot of complaining that Cuomo and Nixon have ignored the upstate towns. New York City is different. I mean, for example, I was on inside City Hall twice by this time in 2014, and now they're telling me after the primary. I did a news conference in front of City Hall a week ago Friday, and it was about housing policy, and the reporters just walked by. We had people there, a banner and everything. They just walked by. So I went into the press room, and the guy from Bloomberg News says, "Oh, you're the people the Russians are supporting." And I happened to be with a woman who, a Peruvian who was a journalist down there and then came here and spent 30 years with the AP, and she just went right into him for his unprofessional conduct. There was only four people in there, it's summer, and two of the reporters didn't even want the news release. The other woman from the New York Times did want it, but she was on deadline, so she had to go back to typing. So that's been frustrating. I expect after the primary I'll be the last progressive standing, and I will get some coverage down there.
When you last ran for governor in 2014, you got 5% of the vote, more than that. How do you understand this show of strength, given the obstacles that you've just been discussing?
Well, I think we're standing with the people on the issues they care about, from fully funding the schools, single-payer health care, to going to 100% clean energy in 2030. And that percentage, I think, has been underappreciated by the media. I think Cuomo, he wanted to run up the vote, get ready to run for president. He actually got a lower percentage than he had got in 2010, and he had to compete for our votes. I think that's why we got a fracking ban and paid family leave, and he's at least talking about the $15 minimum wage and tuition-free public college. And if you put that in perspective, I mean, we got a higher percentage than Norman Thomas ever got running for governor or president. In New York between 1924 and 48. It was more than Eugene Debs got in 1912 when he got 6% nationwide. And actually, if you go back, and New York has a pretty substantial third-party history going back to the Working Men's Party and the Liberty Party against slavery. And, none of those parties ever got the percentage we got. So it's significant, and I hope we can build upon that going forward. But that's enough of a vote that the politicians have to pay attention, because if they don't come our way on some of these issues, our vote's going to keep growing.
There's now an openness for a discussion of socialism. Bernie Sanders, who calls himself a democratic socialist, got 13.2 million votes in the primaries. Who is it that supported him, and why do you think they've got a favorable idea of socialism?
Well, I think it was the millennials, the young folks, that were his biggest block of supporters, and that's simply because their futures are bleak. I mean, a lot of them come out of college in debt, and whether they went to college or not, they just see crappy jobs ahead of them without the kind of security and wages and benefits that their parents had. And he's not just favorable with millennials. I mean, his polling right now is he's the most popular politician, with the most favorable ratings in the country. So he didn't really run as a socialist. They said, "You're a socialist." He said, "Yes, I am." And as he defined it, it was kind of the old-fashioned liberalism of the New Deal, which are social programs to benefit people, but not, you know, that central tenet of the socialist tradition that social ownership of the major means of production is the way we secure economic and political democracy. But I think his campaign opened up a discussion of socialism. You know, I came up in the McCarthy era and the Cold War, and the word socialism was a conversation stopper. Now it's a conversation starter. And the fact that we're talking about what it is can only be good, whether, you know, people are talking about the old New Deal kind of liberalism or, you know, what socialism traditionally was, a really different system of production and distribution.
You know, I co-edited a book several years ago called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, and we went to HarperCollins to see if they were interested in the book, met with the vice president up in his suite, and he looked at me and he said, "How do you define socialism?" And I said, it's not only political, but it's economic democracy. And he said, "Will you take a $10,000 advance?" And I said, "Only if you use it to promote the book." And we got the thing published, and this was 4 years ago. So I totally agree that there's a new openness to the ideas that we're putting out there. What's been the historical experience of socialists running in the Democratic Party?
Well, they disappear. They disappear as a distinct voice, a distinct identity, as something that's different from capitalism. And historically, they end up doing the grunt work in electing liberals. And when they go in there, this happens because they've got to play by the rules or they'll be excluded. They won't be able to be inside the Democratic Party. So, for example, Bernie Sanders had to promise that he would endorse Clinton if he lost the primaries, or they never would have let him on the ballot or let him in the debates. And so that's what tends to happen. I wrote an article for New Politics back in the 90s called Inside Outside or Independent Politics. And that was at a time when the remnants of the Rainbow Coalition were trying to figure out how to move forward, and the new party was talking about fusion and sometimes running independent, sometimes inside. And, you know, I predicted, because of this logic of working in the Democratic Party, they would end up inside, which I think they have. And, you know, you go back in history, I mean, the Greenback Labor Party, which was the big populist party in the 1880s, in New York, they said, "We're going to displace Tammany Hall." Well, they tried to change Tammany Hall. Tammany Hall changed them. They disappeared into the Democratic Party. Then the next wave of populism, the People's Party, they killed themselves when they endorsed the Democrat, Williams Jennings Bryan, in 1896. And then the Socialist Party had a good run and was a significant force in American politics until 1936, when the Communist Popular Front said, "We got to get in a coalition with the New Deal Democrats." And you really haven't had an independent socialist party and movement that's been significant since then. And even the New Left, I mean, after the, you know, the militancy and rhetoric of the late 60s, people like Tom Hayden and the Oakland Panther Party, and they went into the Democratic Party in the 70s, and whatever remnants were left went in to the Jackson campaigns in the 80s. And so we don't have a left that's significant and is different from the Democratic Party. So I think you get lost in the sauce in the Democratic Party. You're in coalition with the big real estate barons and Wall Street and the military contractors. It's not where socialists should be.
Yeah, I think that the devolution of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez proves your point. I mean, it wasn't but a week or so after she won her election here in Queens that she modified her position on Palestine solidarity. A couple weeks later, after John McCain died, she came out and talked about what an exemplary great American he was. She seems to be disappearing into the Democratic Party grasp, like you would have predicted.
Well, I hope she has principles, and, you know, logically she should be in the Green Party or an independent left party if she's really committed to socialism. I mean, she's adopted some of our slogans, like the Green New Deal, although the problem we have, you know, we don't have a copyright on that. We're happy to let the Democrats implement this stuff, but the practice is they take the slogan in and water down what it is, like Andrew Cuomo saying, "I've got a $15 wage. Minimum wage." No, you don't. The minimum wage is $10.40 up here in New York, in upstate, mostly outside of New York City. New York City won't get to $15 until 2020. We won't get to it until the early 2020s, if at all. We get to 1250, then they're going to look at it again. And by the time we get to 15, it's still going to be a poverty wage. So that's why we can have influence by getting a vote, but it'd be better to just elect us into office and we can implement the full program.
What do you think about the what they call the inside-outside approach, where socialists run as independents when they can, and when they can't, they run on the Democratic Party line?
They can always run as an independent. I mean, what's stopping them? I mean, there are ballot access problems, but here in New York, we got the Green Party. It's, you can run as an independent. So I don't see why you would even want to go into the Democratic Party if you're a socialist. You end up in coalition with Andrew Cuomo. You know, I mean, whose politics are you really promoting? I think you get a lot of these very progressive Democrats, and they give the Democrats a better look to progressives than they really are. So, you know, Dennis Kucinich, for example, you know, is very progressive as a member of Congress, and I think they trot people like out him just to, as a friend of mine at Black Agenda Report pointed out, you know, they're sheepdogs. Every 4 years, they're, you know, somebody comes out there to herd people into the Democratic Party. I mean, Sanders played that role last time, and Kucinich played it in 2004. And so people think the Democrats are better than they really are.
Yeah, that was Bruce Dixon who
right.
Coined the sheepdog term, very apt term, I thought. The Green Party has decided to campaign as an ecological socialist party. What does that mean?
Well, it means if we're going to have an ecologically sustainable society, we've got to get democratic and social ownership of key sectors of the economy so we can plan an ecological conversion of production and consumption that can meet everyone's basic needs in a manner that is ecologically sustainable. So that's a general concept. I think the most important thing we got to do now is commit to 100% clean energy and zero net greenhouse emissions by 2030. Because 2030 is really when, well, by doing carbon budgets, the climate scientists have said industrial states like New York have to get there by 2030 if we're going to avoid runaway global warming and a real climate catastrophe. And that's going to require public ownership and democratic control of the energy system, because we can't rely on the Exxons and the National Grids and the Con Eds to make that transition. It means deep cuts in military spending so we can invest that those resources in ecological conversion. We've got to radically reduce the amount of materials going through the economy by having product durability instead of planned obsolescence and zero waste recycling. We got to transform agriculture from fossil fuel and chemical intensive monocultures to sustainable organic farming. Sequester carbon in soils that become living soils again instead of just foundations for plants that are growing on chemical fertilizers. There's a whole program involved, but it all presupposes really a revolution where people take power from the corporate ruling class and democratize it in more democratic political and economic institutions.
Well, that's an agenda that gives us only 12 years to implement. How do you propose getting from where we are now to where we need to be in 12 years?
Well, take the energy demand, 100% clean energy and zero net emissions by 2030. I've campaigned on that since 2010, again in 2014, and now we've got a bill in the state legislature called the New York Off Fossil Fuels Bill, which is a realistic plan to do that. We do have a study from scientists, engineers, and economists at Cornell and Stanford that came out in 2013 that says this is technically feasible and it would be a economic boom for New York. It would create hundreds of thousands of good jobs in manufacturing and construction, and when we're done, electric rates would be half of what they are now. And, you know, we're up against what the Democrats have proposed. It's called the Climate and Community Protection Act. And I'm kind of disappointed in Cynthia Nixon because she keeps touting that, and I don't think she really understands what's in it. For example, it commits right in the legislation to 450 parts per million carbon equivalents in the atmosphere to keep us to not going over 2 degrees Celsius rise, which is seen as sort of the tipping point where runaway global warming happens. That science is over a decade or a dozen years old. There's an organization called 350.org because we've got to get below 350 parts per million if we're going to have any hope of averting this climate catastrophe. And basically, this Climate Community Protection Act codifies Andrew Cuomo's program. For example, 50% renewable electricity by 2030. That's in the legislation. That's only 14% of the carbon footprint would be reduced. And then as far as carbon emissions, they do change Cuomo's goal to 80% to 100%, but it's by 2050, 20 years too late. And then you get into the weeds with it, and it doesn't oppose frack gas infrastructure, the New York off bill does. It doesn't oppose nuclear power, the New York off bill does. The New York off bill has real benchmarks in there, like carbon-free new construction by 2020, zero-emission vehicles by 2025, and requires every county and municipality of 50,000 people or more to have a climate action plan that would be integrated into the whole statewide plan. So that's the kind of thing we got to be doing. We know it's technically feasible. What's missing is the political will. And I think it's just irresponsible for climate activists and progressive Democrats to be supporting this bill that basically codifies Cuomo's program, which is totally inadequate. Doesn't do what the science says we've got to do.
What other demands, in addition to what you've laid out with respect to our energy system, but what other demands are you putting forward as the Green Party candidate for Governor Howie Hawkins?
Well, I'm running on the same theme of a Green New Deal for New York, which this isn't energy, it's an economic bill of rights, like FDR called for in his last State of the State address, State of the Union address in 1945, like the Civil Rights Movement picked up and added an end to discrimination in employment, education, and housing. So it involves a job guarantee, and massive investment in infrastructure and transit and public housing is how we can get that in New York. Or an income above poverty for those who cannot work or should not work because they're too old, too young, disabled, taking care of children, and so forth. And we should build that right into the income tax structure as a negative income tax or refundable tax credit that would be paid monthly so people can pay their bills. Second thing would be a decent home for all. That involves rent control, going statewide with that, but also getting rid of the Erstad law so you don't have, you know, Republican senators representing farmers upstate voting on rent regulations in New York City. That's absurd. Should have local control. And then we've got to expand affordable housing in the most effective way, the most cost-effective way to do that is public housing. Third thing is comprehensive health care. We have the New York Health Act that would set up a single public payer and save us all money. Fourth thing is a good education, fully funded public schools from pre-K through public college. And we need a governor who wouldn't be in court like Andrew Cuomo has his attorney general now, fighting lawsuits from my city, Syracuse, and the parents of my city and New York City is one lawsuit in seven small cities and another trying to get the full funding promised by the foundation aid formula. That should be settled and the funding should be coming. And then the fifth thing is a sustainable environment. The centerpiece of that is moving to 100% clean energy. So that's like the core of our program. And then the question is, well, people say, how are you going to pay for that? And I say, we're going to tax the rich. Their share of income in the state has grown from 12% in 1980 to 31% today. They get almost one-third of every dollar in the economy just goes to that 1%. That's $375 billion a year. If we raise their taxes 10%, we got $37.5 billion to fix NYCHA and the NTA for the clean energy program, the public housing program, fix the water and sewer systems, all that infrastructure that's been crumbling. And that's how we fund it. And we can fund tuition-free college. That's about $2 billion. The gap in public school funding is about $4 billion cumulative, short of what the foundation aid provided. The money is there. Cuomo says he's a progressive who's broke. Yeah, he's broke because he won't tax his campaign contributors, who tend to be the very rich. So that's another thing. We want to go public ownership in key sectors, including energy, broadband, health insurance, and we want a state bank that could finance infrastructure at half the cost of going through Wall Street and also promote worker cooperatives by providing planning and technical assistance in financing. And then finally, you know, we got to deal with the criminal justice system, which is, you know, an outrage. Bail abolition, speedy trial like Kalief's law, treat drug abuse as a health problem, not a criminal problem, and so forth. There's a lot we need to do in this state.
What kind of party are you trying to build, Howie Hawkins? You're running for governor of the state of New York, and you have a party. Is that a party that you want to see where members pay dues, where members go to meetings, where members have a say-so in the program, and contrast this to the so-called Republican and Democratic parties.
Yeah, they are not really parties where rank-and-file members have any say whatsoever. By the time they get to the primary, there's been a money primary beforehand, which has determined the choices. So the rich are choosing the choices and then giving people, you know, it's like Tweed, Boss Tweed used to say, you can vote for whoever you want as long as I get to pick the candidates. So that's what we're trying to overcome. What we're trying to build is an invention of the workers' movement, the left, in the 19th century. In order to compete with the, you know, the traditional parties like in England, the Whigs and the Tories, which were built from the top down. They were caucuses in the parliament, and the rich would support their faction. And the workers' movement said, well, the only way we compete with that is like the way we do with our unions. Everybody puts in some money, and then we meet and decide what our program is and what we're going to do, what our actions will be.
Howie Hawkins, how do people get in touch with you and the Green Party?
Well, if you're online, go to howiehawkins.org. And you can read what we're about. You can send us your information and volunteer and get on the list to get information about the campaign and what we're doing. You can donate there. That's probably the best place to go. We'll get you involved if you want to be involved.
Coming down to the end of our allotted time, unfortunately, but I wanted to ask you before we close, what have been some of the highlights of your campaign so far?
Well, it was recruiting such great running mates. Gia Lee is a public school teacher in New York running for lieutenant governor. She has been one of the best organizers of teachers, not just in New York, but around the country. I mean, you heard about these strikes in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, one's coming up in Los Angeles and Seattle. She was an advisor to those teachers. She was just down in Puerto Rico helping their teachers union fight the total privatization, the disaster capitalism in the wake of Hurricane Maria that's being imposed on that state. And then we got Michael Sussman to run for attorney general, who has more experience. He's been in the courts for 40 years, state and federal courts, including the Supreme Court. And he's a civil rights, environmental, public corruption lawyer, and has won a number of landmark cases. Probably people may know about the Yonkers housing and desegregation cases. If they saw that HBO special, Show Me a Hero, he's the lawyer in that. That was about Yonkers. He won a $45 million settlement for black and Latino state workers against the biases in promotion and the testing and the civil service system. He took on Westchester County, which wouldn't indict a white police officer who murdered a black student named D.J. Henry and got the family a $6 million settlement. I mean, this guy's resume, you put all the Democrats and Republicans up against his and he towers over them. And then Mark Dunley for comptroller, he wants to divest the pension fund for fossil fuels, but he has more experience than DiNapoli. He was a board member of the Fiscal Policy Institute for years and has worked on public corruption going back to when he was a law student working with Ralph Nader and NYPERG, and they filed a citizens taxpayer lawsuit that gave New York residents the right to file suit against illegal expenditures of government money. So, you know, the highlight has been getting such a great ticket to run with.
And what has been the reaction so far to your campaign?
Well, when I talk to the voters one-on-one, you know, just a lot of people are, you're running against Cuomo? Great. You're outside of two parties? Great. And, you know, I really don't give my campaign pitch to them. I mostly ask them, you know, I tell them I'm trying to stand for the regular people against special interests and ask them what their concerns are. And, you know, people pour it out. They're really angry that the government, you know, won't do something about getting good jobs and decent wages because the rent, the health care, college, and upstate property taxes are just going up and up. And people are having trouble paying their bills and even staying in their homes. So that's the most common thing I hear from the voters. And, you know, a lot of them are just glad that there's an alternative that they can consider.
On a personal note, Howie Hawkins, if you don't mind my asking, how did you get to where you are now? You probably started off not that particularly political. What was it that caused you to develop the kind of ideas that you now hold?
Well, I came up in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 1960s. So I'm 12 years old, 1964. Reagan is campaigning against fair housing, a referendum to repeal the law that had just passed in California. And I'm from a Republican family, and I'm saying we're not the party of Lincoln anymore. Let's look at the Democrats. And I watched them seat the Dixiecrats instead of the Freedom Democrats from Mississippi. So I asked myself, where's my party? And my party ended up, at that point, a few years later, being the Peace and Freedom Party, a coalition between the Independent Socialist Clubs and the Black Panther Party. Peace in Vietnam, freedom was the civil rights slogan. And so I was swept up in the 60s, civil rights and anti-war, and, you know, I never stopped.
I can tell you the same history. Howie Hawkins, how do people get a hold of you once more?
Go to our website, howiehawkins.org, and that'll tell you, you know, how to hook up with the campaign, give us your contact information, and how you can volunteer or donate and or donate. And just read about, you know, what we're talking about. All our press releases are up there, the news coverage, our platform, some op-eds and commentaries, a lot of information.
Howie Hawkins, it's been a great pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. Good luck to you, and you take it easy.
All right. Thank you very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Slavery never ended, human rights attorney Brian Stevenson has observed. It just evolved. One form of this evolution is the huge number of African American men in America's prisons and the conditions of their confinement. More than half of America's 2.3 million prisoners are African Americans. Many prisoners, black, brown, Latino, and white, went on strike on August 21st. The strike ended on September 9, 2018. The prisoners did work stoppages, sit-ins, commissary boycotts, and hunger strikes to demand major reforms to our country's prison and criminal justice system. They demanded humane living conditions, access to rehabilitation, sentencing reform, and an end to what many of them said was modern-day slavery. We're joined today by Paul Wright. He's the founder and the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He is also the editor of Prison Legal News, the longest-running independent prisoner rights publication in the United States. A former prisoner himself, Paul Wright was behind bars for 17 years in the state of Washington until his release in 2003. Paul Wright, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Paul, it's hard enough to organize a strike or even a work stoppage in a factory or a plant where workers have freedom of motion. How was this strike organized?
Well, this strike, I can say this in the context that I've organized work strikes in prison myself in Washington State for 17 years, and I've organized everything from work strikes to food boycotts to education boycotts and stuff like that. So organizing strikes within an individual prison is easy enough because, well, everyone's in pretty close confinement, and so in that respect, it's easy. What makes it harder, of course, is the repression by the prison officials, a.k.a. the slave masters, who want to keep everyone enslaved and working away. So that's kind of like, you know, one of the bigger challenges. What we're seeing, though, what's interesting about this strike is that previously we've seen statewide strikes. California prisoners a few years ago mounted statewide hunger strikes, and so we've been able to see statewide strikes. I organized a statewide strike in Washington State in the 1990s. But what makes this strike and last year's strikes truly unique is that for the first time we're seeing prisoners trying to organize strikes on a national level, and we're seeing prisoners that are seeking to organize themselves as prisoners nationally across state lines, not just confined to one prison.
Give us a picture of this. What prisons are involved? How many states are involved? What kind of guess do you have in terms of the number of prisoners that are involved? I mean, it's really quite an extraordinary phenomena.
So far, it's been things are kind of fuzzy, and I think what we did last year, and with Prison Legal News, we're a monthly magazine, so, you know, we don't have a huge amount of pressure, I think, to be in the daily news cycle. So what we did last year is we went through all the published news reports, we went through all the social media accounts, we got our correspondence from prisoners, from our prisoner subscribers from around the country, and everyone that had written to us about it, and we're able to basically put together a pretty comprehensive view after the fact of, you know, how big or widespread the strike had been. And it's just one of those things that it's kind of difficult to do that while things are still unfolding, and there's a lot of reasons for that, one of which is the enormous efforts that prison officials make in basically keeping the public in the dark and ignorant of what's happening, as well as ensuring that the public doesn't know what's going on in prisons and jails. And so to the extent that, you know, we do find out about what's going on, it's either prisoners write us letters, and it takes a while to get here and get compiled and analyzed, and then through social media. That's also one of the other ways of finding out, and some of the stuff is being posted by friends and family members of prisoners or people who visit prisons and can then post that information.
Paul Wright, what's the significance of the starting and ending dates of this prison strike? Started on August 21st and projected to stop on September 11th. What's the significance of those two dates?
Well, the dates are very significant because August 21st was when in 1971 California prison guards murdered George Jackson. He was a California prisoner and activist. He was a member of the Black Panther Party, and he was a prison organizer and writer in California, and he was murdered on August 21st. And then September 11th is when the Attica Rebellion in New York State kicked off in what would later become, I think, until the Waco massacre. I think at that point, the Attica Uprising, I think, was the bloodiest encounter on American soil between American citizens since the Civil War ended. And dozens of prisoners and prison employees that had been taken hostage were killed when National Guardsmen, state police, and prison guards stormed the prison and retook it. And, you know, I think that's kind of the big the symbolism of these dates. And I think that's also one of the things that's significant is that the strike organizers are now they're having a solid start date and an end date for the strike of, you know, when they will work. When they will be working, when they won't. And I think, you know, that's pretty significant for, you know, for various reasons as well.
Paul Wright, let's talk about the demands of the prisoners who are striking. They've demanded an end to what they call present-day slavery. Their demand is for a prevailing wage in the state or territory where they labor. What, if anything, are prisoners paid?
Well, you know, it literally depends on the state, because some states prisoners earn a nominal wage, and in fact they don't even call it a wage, they call it a gratuity. And then in other states, prisoners are literally paid nothing. In the states of Florida, Texas, Arkansas, and I believe Georgia, prisoners are literally paid nothing. They're not even paid a token wage, they're not even paid, you know, anything at all. And I think that's the very definition of slavery. You know, you force people to work at gunpoint and punish them if they don't, and you don't pay them anything. You're literally stealing their labor, taking their labor. So that's, I think, first and foremost, I think that's one of the main demands, is that prisoners should be paid at a minimum, the minimum wage, and more importantly, be allowed to keep it. And because I think that's one of the things that happens too, is some states, they have programs that are called prison industry enhancement programs, where prisoners are nominally paid the minimum wage, but then the state then seizes all or most of their so-called wages, so the prisoners don't see it. So at the end of the day, they're back to working for pennies an hour. To the extent this is one of the main complaints, or one of the big complaints, that's probably also the most obvious one. And unfortunately, that's part of the problem is the Constitution of the U.S., is that the Constitution, it doesn't mandate that prisoners be enslaved, but it allows it, because the United States never abolished slavery. They merely limited it to people that have been convicted of a crime.
Yeah, we're talking about the 13th Amendment, which freed slaves, but made an exception for people in prison. Let's talk about what's been called the prison industrial complex. I mean, for one thing, prisoners run the prisons. They clean it up, they cook the food, they do the laundry. I mean, if it wasn't for prisoners working, those prisons wouldn't run. But secondly, and this is what was so shocking when I first learned about it, are all the various American corporations that employ these prisoners as either slave labor or really cheap labor. Can you talk about those two aspects of the prison industrial complex?
Sure. Sure. I'd say the first one, as far as like the number of companies that employ prisoners as cheap slave labor, there's really not that many of them. And, you know, the number of prisoners that are working for these companies is around 6,000 on any given day. And when you factor that in with the 2.5 million people that are locked up on any given day, and then also throw in, you know, the size of the American economy, that's a very, you know, these are very small numbers. But I think politically it's significant because one of the things that I find interesting, and I think you can almost call this the imperialist double standard, is in the United States it's actually a crime to import prisoner-made goods from other countries. Yet, on the other hand, the United States actually exports prison-made goods to other countries. So, and you know, I think it's also part of the thing about the hypocrisy, I think, of a lot of the corporate media in this country is that the use of prison slave labor in China and other countries is recognized as a human rights violation, but the use of prison slave labor in this country is deemed to be good public policy. And so, you know, so that those are kind of some of the problems there. But then, you know, but then when it comes down to, you know, as you know, prisoners run the prisons. They are, they're the ones who cook the food for the most part. They're the ones who wash the laundry. They're the janitors or the landscapers. Then, of course, there's the state-run prison industries, the most famous one being they make license plates, everything from furniture for state agencies to clothes for prisoners and things like that. This is what actually keeps the prison system running. It's the prisoners that are doing this stuff. And if the prisoners weren't doing it, they would have to presumably pay someone at least the minimum wage to do it. And that's anathema to the slave masters that run the current prison system because they don't want to spend any more money enslaving people than they have to.
Continuing our discussion about the demands that these striking prisoners are raising, the prisoners are demanding an end to the Truth in Sentencing Act and also demanding an end to the Sentencing Reform Act. How do these two laws affect the possibility of prisoners getting rehabilitation and getting parole?
Well, I'm not sure if they affect necessary rehabilitation, but what they do is they require prisoners to serve at least 85% of their sentences before they are released. So basically what these laws effectively did is they lengthened the amount of time that prisoners actually serve in prison. So that's kind of like their main goal is they lengthen the prison sentences being served. And it wasn't just that, but there's also one of the impacts that during Bill Clinton's administration they did was they provided funding to states that changed their sentencing laws to require prisoners to serve at least 85% of their sentences. Those states receive billions of dollars in federal funding to build more prisons and cage more people. So that's, I think, you know, that's one of the connections there is that, you know, prior to those laws, prisoners generally served anywhere between half to two-thirds of their prison sentence.
The prisoners are also demanding an immediate end to the conditions of their imprisonment and that their humanity be recognized. Your thoughts on this, please, Paul, especially with reference to your own experience. I mean, you served 17 years.
Yes, and I think that as far as being recognized as human beings, I mean, that's a huge part of it because, for one thing, the enslavement of prisoners, the current trend of seeing prisoners and their families as profit centers to be exploited and gouged, I mean, these are all things that negate the humanity of the people that are being caged and where people are just viewed as literally a chattel to be caged, managed, and exploited, you know, as need be. In some respects, it's almost, you know, I think there's a lot of similarities almost between how prison officials view the prisoners and their captivity and their families and how agribusiness views the cows or the pigs or and their feedlots as, you know, they're just animals to be exploited. They're not anything, they're not viewed as sentient beings or beings at all. So you know, so I think that's kind of part of the overall problem. But again, it's not just prison officials that do this. I think, you know, legislators and politicians have been doing this for decades. I mean, unfortunately, we've got, you know, at this point almost one or two generations of Americans that have grown up never hearing a politician in elected office referring to people in prison as anything other than caricatures or dehumanized things. rights, basically, for, you know, just for lack of a better word. So I think, you know, these trends are far-reaching. But I also think what's interesting is that, you know, I think the strike is the culmination of those very practices and dehumanizations. I think that things have gotten to the point and are getting to the point where prisoners as a class are saying they've had enough. They're not going to be treated as animals. And I think that was one of the rallying cries of the Attica Rebellion, when one of the prisoners said, "We are not beasts and we won't be driven as such."
When I was working with the Center for Constitutional Rights, we won a lawsuit here in New York on the telephone situation, where prisoners were charged about four times as much as people normally pay for telephone calls. Their family had to pay that much. And also, just trying to send money to prisoners, you have to pay a premium to give them money. I think that's two illustrations of the kind of exploitation that goes on with these people. But let's talk about overcharging prisoners. One of the demands is an end to racially overcharging them and oversentencing them, parole denials to black and brown prisoners especially. Are prisoners of color denied parole because the victim of their crimes were white? And is this a particular problem in southern states?
The studies that I've seen on it show that basically anytime there's a white victim, regardless of the race of the perpetrator, the sentence tends to be longer and harsher than when the victim is a person of color. And that's usually one of the things that drives that. Almost all studies that have been done show that when it comes to sentencing, that as a general rule, defendants of color are generally going to wind up getting harsher sentences. This is when you account for all the factors, when you account for criminal history, crime that was charged or crime that was convicted of, and everything else. Is that generally speaking, people that are defendants of color are going to wind up getting longer sentences. And that said, though, I think that it's important to note, though, it's not like white prisoners are getting a free ride on this. I mean, usually what we're talking about is it's not a thing of like the black defendant got 10 years and the white defendant got 1 year. It's usually more like the white defendant got nine years and 2 months, and the black defendant got 10 years. Is, you know, when they're looking at this, yes, they are objectively longer sentences, but again, it's not like it's a huge number per se, or that there's, you know, just the free ride type thing here. And I think that one of the things that the strike points out, though, or brings out, is the fact that, yeah, the United States has this massive prison population, and what it's doing in part is it's just encompassing bigger and bigger swathes of the American population in general, almost all of whom are poor, regardless of their race. And when you start factoring people that are on parole and probation, yeah, we've got this massive section of our population that's under some form of police state control, more so than the rest of us. But, you know, they're under actual police state control if they're actually in a cage or they're in a virtual cage of probation and parole.
Yeah, I kind of look at them as people that the system counts as surplus people. There are no jobs, there's no really place in society for them, so they warehouse them. Is that your view?
Yeah, I actually agree with that. I think that's a good view, and I also think too that beyond that is that we've got kind of the flip side of this, is that on the one hand, we've got this huge surplus population of people that are caged on any given day, 2.5 million of them, and then on the other hand, it's also turned into basically this vast jobs program. You've got all these people that are employed by prisons and jails. I mean, on any given day, there's at least 1 million people in this country that are sucking down a paycheck, a government paycheck, based on caging other people. And whether it's coming from prisoner jail guards or secretaries or doctors or administrators or whatever, and then it gets even bigger when you factor in all the people that are employed supplying the tools of the American police state. When you start thinking about that, and it's like, oh, okay, you know, now we've got the people that are making razor wire, the people that are making handcuffs and jumpsuits and stuff like that. That's when you come to realize just how many people depend on their economic existence for just being able to cage other people. And that's, I think, you know, some of the huge numbers that are overlooked, both the people that are directly caged and the people that are directly employed watching over the caged.
What about the demands for more funds for rehabilitation services? What's the extent of the lack of these services?
Well, pretty much under Bill Clinton's administration in the 90s, higher education was largely ended throughout the American prison system. And what few rehabilitation programs existed in the 90s were pretty much eliminated and destroyed and have basically never come back. And, you know, to the extent that there's some very modest or minimal rehabilitation programs, they're just that, very modest and very minimal.
What's a Pell Grant, and why are the prisoners demanding that they must be reinstated?
Pell Grants were named after Senator Claiborne Pell of Rhode Island, and what they did is they provided for non-prisoners, they provide I think it's around $4,500 or $500 in a grant to assist with college tuition and college expenses for qualified students who go to college. And what happened is before Bill Clinton and the Republican Congress of 1994 eliminated it, Pell Grants did not distinguish between prisoners and non-prisoners. It was strictly a needs-based assessment. So basically, prisoners between the time of the Pell Grants being created and by the time of their elimination, prisoners were largely using Pell Grants to pay for college education programs. And so when Bill Clinton eliminated those Pell Grant programs, that pretty much eliminated the funding for prison-based education. And so then what happened was the states then jumped on board the bandwagon, and what state funding there was also eliminated. So that pretty much signaled the end of any type of higher education in prison. Today, prisoners are lucky if they can get a GED, and that's about the extent of, you know, what passes education in prison these days.
One of the reasons that prisoners are relatively powerless is that many, in many states, citizens serving prison sentences or pretrial detention or ex-felons are not allowed to vote. Please talk about the demand for voting rights and the extent that this disallowance has affected people.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's pushing this is the whole thing of, you know, I think this goes back to the slavery questions. You know, slaves can't vote, so, well, neither can prisoners in this country. Except for Maine and Vermont, prisoners can vote. What we've seen, what's happened in this country, too, is that a lot of former prisoners, people that have been convicted of crimes, are not allowed to vote, even if they're not in prison. Florida, for example, disenfranchises over a million of its non-prisoners because of prior felony convictions. So, you know, that's kind of a big problem. You know, it's kind of a big problem around the country, and it's one that continues to grow exponentially as the prison population and the felon population grows as well. You know, this demand is I think, related to the whole thing about, you know, we're cutting people out of the political process. I would say that there's a bigger issue than that of being able to vote is, as someone who's been a prisoner and has been convicted of a felony, I can vote. I've had my voting rights restored, but on the issues I'm interested in, especially criminal justice issues, I don't have anyone to vote for. Like, even if I'm looking at very minimalistic issues like, okay, what politicians are against the death penalty? You know, what politician says that the government shouldn't be in the business of killing its own citizens? I really don't have anyone to vote for in most states. And I live in Florida, so it's a real problem. Even the so-called progressive candidates are all down with the death penalty. So, you know, so I think that's kind of a bigger issue. But just being able to vote in the first place, even if you have no one to vote for, I think that's one of the issues that differentiates citizens from slaves, is the right to vote and the right to participate in the political process, no matter how skewed, biased, and meaningless it may be.
And when they do get out of prison, they're denied all sorts of benefits, getting into public housing, for example, or trying to get a job. And many of the prisoners end up back in prison, don't they?
Generally speaking, depending on the state, anywhere between 40 and 80% of most states' prison population is functionally illiterate. And I think when you start thinking about that is, if you're functionally illiterate, what are your job prospects in this country? And in general, they're not very great. And to me, the education thing is really, I think, the thing that really exposes, I think, the contradictions of the American police state. Because as a society, as a country, how many hundreds of billions of dollars do we spend every year to educate children, to educate our citizens? Yet, when it comes to prisons, our government actually makes the conscious decision to not only spend any money at all to educate people that where the education system has failed them already and are illiterate or functionally illiterate as a result of it and can prove it. The more education people get in prison, the lower their recidivism rate is. When they've done studies, and we've had like 60 years of research on this, so it's not like this isn't one of those things where there was some obscure study done in the 1940s and who knows what it would show today, but it's like, no, this actually, the results are pretty consistent. The more education people get in prison, the lower their recidivism rate. The average, depending on the state and how you're defining it, recidivism rates for prisoners are between 40 and 60%. By the time prisoners are getting a college degree, a four-year bachelor's degree, the recidivism rate is down to 6%. By the time they're getting a master's degree, it's down to zero. One would think that from a public safety perspective, that this is the investment we would want to make both to protect society, protect our communities, and also help people that have made mistakes, help people that are in prison.
Paul Wright, it's been a real pleasure and honor having you on Law and Disorder. How can our listeners find out more about the strike and its aftermath, and how can they be in touch with you and your organization?
Sure. Well, the easiest way is prisonlegalnews.org is our website. It's a monthly magazine. We report on all aspects of the criminal justice system, dealing with prisons and detention facilities. We have a free daily newsletter that goes out electronically. We have a monthly magazine. We have a whole trove of information about everything that's going on in the American prison and jail system. We also publish another magazine called criminallegalnews.org. Which can be accessed on that website, which reports on policing issues as well as criminal law and procedure and sentencing. And so if you want to find out what's happening with the police, prosecutors, and judges at the front end of the criminal justice system, criminallegalnews.org is the publication that has all that for you. Prisons and jails, go to prisonlegalnews.org. And all of our contact information is there as well. You can get a hold of me, get a hold of the rest of our team at the Human Rights Defense Center on those two websites.
The great Russian novelist and humanist Dostoevsky wrote that a measure of a civilization is how it treats its people in prison. We're all grateful for you, Paul Wright, for exposing what the United States does to its prisoners, and grateful for your good work. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.